court will proceed to the third case, Young versus James Green Management Company. Yes, Ms. Barica?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Usually that name's not pronounced correctly. You got it correct.
Well, good. Good. I don't always bat a thousand, but...
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Bob Parikh, and I represent two plaintiffs in this case on a race discrimination case that was consolidated for trial, and it was heard in front of Judge Patrick Murphy in the Southern District of Illinois. And I'm asking this court to reverse or actually grant me a new trial based on evidentiary rulings of Judge Murphy, and I'll just start with them right out. The first, which I thought was the most important, there was a letter, a February 11th letter written by a property manager employed by James Green Management at the time he wrote the letter. It was a letter of resignation. And in his letter of resignation, he said, "I hereby resign effective immediately," and then gave the reasons for his why he was wanting to depart. It was because he was told to fire two black gentlemen just simply because they were black, basically. And the letter's in the record. Judge Murphy ruled that everything after the word immediately did not come in because he resigned effective immediately, even though the letter was still at his home, hadn't even been sent, which just is beyond any legal case that I've seen. And I even asked the judge, I go, "Judge, are you saying if he wrote that letter?" And then at the very end, he said, "I hereby resign because of the above, it would be in." He said, "Yes." I just think that is just beyond legal reasoning. The cases that I've cited all say the earliest that the letter of resignation is effective is when it shows up at the employer, not when it's written at home. And it falls under all sections of 8D2 that says he's an agent at the time that he wrote the letter. It was referring to a matter that happened a week and a half earlier. He is a property manager, hired and fired people. His boss told him to...
What is the rationale for allowing hearsay statements made by someone in the employ of a corporation to be admissible against the corporation? Why do we allow them? Why do we allow that exception?
Well, a corporation can only act through its agents.
That's right.
And here's a managerial person being told, tell me another managerial person, keep this guy hid out and get rid of him as soon as you can. We don't want blacks here.
What makes that statement sufficiently trustworthy that it ought to be admitted? There must be a rationale for this rule.
Well,
and as you well point out, and I think there's great force to your argument, the district court gave us a rather mechanistic one. Why should it have been allowed? There's a policy matter.
Well,
that rule's there for a reason.
Well, under 8D2, or 8D2, actually, 2 capital letter D at the end, it lays out when those admissions are admissible. So based on the rule, it's admissible. Now, the rationale for it is because if managerial people are making these decisions, they're obviously reflective of the corporate attitude towards blacks,
Do you think that in this letter, whether the statement came in the first paragraph or the second paragraph or at the end of the letter, that we can really say that this gentleman's message, attitude, was reflective of corporate policy or corporate position? The man was resigning. He was charging the company with something. He wasn't acting on the company's behalf.
Well, Your Honor, in 30 years at this apartment complex in Bethalto, Illinois, which borders Alton, which is for about 25 or 30% black, there were no black employees at this place in 30 years. Now,
about the admission of a particular piece of evidence, and it's whether or not we can bank on its truthfulness, its veracity. And I'm just trying to see how there was a community of interest between the person who wrote this letter and the corporation, on whose behalf he's supposed to be speaking. That's the whole theory.
I understand that, but that would be for the jury to decide. If they wanted to rebut that, they would have had every opportunity to bring
in. Isn't there a threshold requirement? The judge is supposed to determine whether the jury, in fact, ought to be able to consider it for that purpose?
Well, Judge, there should be, but Judge Murphy ruled that everything after the word immediately did not come in, saying he was not, you know, because he resigned effective immediately, so apparently...
You and I think are probably in agreement that, you know, that wasn't a terribly convincing reason the judge gave. But, you know, you can be right for the wrong reasons, and...
That's possible,
and that's what I'm just trying to explore with you.
My only argument, using the cases that I cited in the rule, it should have been admissible. I don't know if I'm not answering the court's question, and I apologize if I'm not.
I don't want to get into your time, but I just wanted to raise this with you. It's a problem.
I see. The second evidentiary ruling was on the EEOC decision finding discrimination in this case. All the cases that exclude, Mr. Carr cited a couple of them in his brief, you have to find that there was, that the report was flawed for some reason, or it was not reliable, it was untrustworthy. In this particular case, there were no, and in the record, Your Honor, there's three binders full of what the EEOC did in this case. They interviewed all the employees, past employees. Those are all contained in those documents. Judge Murphy ruled without even looking at them that they're not admissible. Now, Chandler versus Rody Bush, the Supreme Court case on this matter, says that they are admissible, and the cases that don't follow Chandler distinguish it by saying if you can show that there's some unreliability that's evident from the record, then of course the court has discretion whether or not to let that particular report in.
Is your argument that the trial judge here simply didn't pay enough attention to the issue? He certainly has some discretion on whether to accept this stuff or not. What did he do wrong? I mean, was he under a misapprehension of the law where he simply said, hey, you know, this isn't admissible? No. He exercised discretion. Where did he trip up so that we can refer to him on an abuse of discretion?
First, Your Honor, he didn't even look at the EEOC material when he ruled in his motion in limine. Second, there were no depositions, no witnesses, nothing from EEOC on the record to reflect that these were not admissible at his motion when he granted, you know, when he excluded it in the motion in limine. I think he should, if he had heard some, you know, if there were some depositions that had some kind of erroneous material in there or something that was pointed out to him, then he would exercise his discretion based on what he heard and the record that he's looking at. He didn't do that in this case at all.
Okay, I have your point. Thanks.
He didn't make any specific reference to this report when he found it generally unreliable, Mr. Parisa?
At the motion in limine hearing, there was no material before him. I had the actual finding, and I thought I was in good shape because of Chandler versus Rody Bush, but he excluded it. He really didn't give reason.
The report itself was never submitted to him.
Well, I tried to get the report admitted in evidence.
Was it offered up to... Do we have anything in the record to indicate that the court looked at the report?
Not at that time, Your Honor. Now, I made an offer of proof during trial on a particular part of the record of EEOC, but I did that because I was excluded before trial from bringing in the actual determination that found that there was discrimination.
Look at it at that time?
Did he look at the record or the report?
The report.
Well, now the determination I'm calling, I don't want to mess up with terminology, the report itself that I'm talking about is the determination that found discrimination. Then there are three binders contained in the record that have everything that EEOC did to come up with their determination. He didn't look at that, those binders.
What did he look at from your...
The only thing I can say that he looked at was the determination that I handed him, asking that it be admitted based on Chandler versus Rody Bush. And then when he didn't change his ruling, I asked if he was changing his ruling. He said, no, that's when I made my offer of proof on a particular issue contained within that determination. The last thing I'd like to talk about is I had filed a motion in limine. It was the only ruling that I got favorable from Judge Murphy was he granted my motion in limine, not allowing Mr. Carr to go into criminal details of crimes of this witness that I had to bring because he's the one that wrote the letter and the letter was not admissible. And Mr. Carr got into, he impregnated a witness that was before the jury in a wheelchair. He beat up the dad. He all in violation of the motion limiting. When I kept objecting, the judge said this is cross-examination in violation of his own motion in limiting. All these collateral issues, Mr. Carr was even allowed to bring in some transcript from another case of this witness, Lubert, that was in a wheelchair, and read from it and impeach this witness, Gary Olson, who's not my client, on these collateral issues. There's just no basis to allow anyone to do that in a court when it's not relevant at all to the case before the court, which was Mr. Mays and Mr. Young. And there's several details, pages of it. And then he also allowed Mr. Carr for 20 minutes to talk about his background. Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, you may complete your thought. Okay.
The last thing I would say, Your Honor, is that page 144 of the record, even Judge Murphy, in his after the jury was excused for a while at a recess, said he didn't know if the jury could overcome the testimony of this Gary Olson, where he got to go into impregnating the lady, beating up the parents, beating her up, and all this stuff, which was not relevant in any manner whatsoever to our client and was prejudicial, which we feel demands a new trial in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Parikh. Mr. Carr.
Thank you, Your Honor. Of course, I represent the defendant in this case. The EEOC determination was considered by the court. A hearing was held in the record, volume 2, page 146. The court considered the terminations. The EEOC investigator took the stand and testified in an offer of proof that the plaintiffs made. They had the right in that offer of proof to put anything forward in the judge. They put the record in there. How can they possibly say that the trial judge, having this hearing, did not consider everything they presented? They had the determinations. They had the binders. This was a hearing at trial, not on the motion in limine, but on the offer of proof they made at trial. Obviously, the court found that these determinations were unreliable. We demonstrated that simply, and the evidence itself demonstrates that the determination was unreliable. They did no investigation. They didn't even talk to the writer of the letter. And the court was well within its discretion in determining that it was unreliable. Insofar as the statement of an agent of the company being considered an admission of the company, the reason for that is obviously agents do speak for companies, but they have to be doing it at that time in behalf of the company, not in behalf of themselves. The statement made by Olson, whether he was an employee at that time he made the statement or not, was obviously made not in behalf of the company. It was made to hurt the company, not as an agent of the company, but as a dissident ex-employee of the company. And even if he had been an employee, it did not serve the purpose of the rule allowing admission of such statements into evidence. Yes, Judge Murphy was mechanistic in deciding, as he stated on the record, that the words effective immediately meant what they said and nothing after that counted. But in point of fact, the record showed that this man was no longer an employee of the company as of February the 7th. He wrote, and it's clear in the record, he had not been to work for 4 days. Jim Green Management Company has a policy. When a person doesn't show up for work for 3 days, they're considered terminated or quit. It's not like the cases that counsel has cited that the resignation has to be effective. That's balderdash. Those cases deal with municipal and governmental employees, not employees of private companies. You don't have to resign to no longer be an employee. All you do is fail to show up to work. Don't get paid. He wasn't paid since the 7th of February. He didn't work since the 7th of February. They were in the process of changing locks because he hadn't shown up for work when his letter of resignation was faxed to them. Now, this man was not an employee when he wrote the letter. He wrote the letter not intending to serve the interests of the employer, but to hurt the employer. Insofar as the cross-examination is concerned, Olson was a serial liar. He collaborated with Young, not with Mays, as far as we know, but he collaborated with Young to induce Young to quit work so that he could get paid. Young didn't try to find a job for 20 months after he was terminated from Green. Lubert, an independent witness who had been living with Olson, testified. They didn't rebut or try to deny what she said in her testimony. Admittedly, on direct, they said they didn't do any such thing, but she wrote a letter to Green and testified that she was present in an automobile when Olson met with Young, and they determined that Young should try to get himself fired by stopping work. And that's what happened. He was a good worker up to the time he met with Olson. He was promoted by the company to be a supervisor. But after he met with Olson, he simply quit working, as the other members of the crew quit working. They quit picking up the trash. They were told to pick up the trash. They didn't. So Green Management let all four people go. Two white, two black were let go because they quit work. They didn't do the job. And I might say, four workers hired after these four were fired were also fired within a couple of weeks because they didn't work out. Race was not a part or a pattern of Jim Green Management Company, and the evidence showed it. Everything that defendant's counsel did in cross-examination of their star witness was provoked or invited by what the star witness said on direct examination. The simple thing, they said on direct examination, were you convicted of a felony? Yes, I was convicted of a felony. In point of fact, he was convicted of four felonies, one stealing an automobile, a truck, and three aggravated batteries. He lied. And if the court examines the record, the court will see that the judge was well within his discretion in allowing an examination to reveal what a liar their star witness was. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carr. Ms. Parika?
Yeah, briefly, Your Honors, I didn't want to get into the facts, but the changing of the locks occurred the morning that they received the letter of resignation from Mr. Olson. If he wasn't working, he was off sick. He called in. If he wasn't working, why would he write a letter of resignation to quit? It doesn't make any sense. In this alleged discussion between Young and Olson after the fact, there was no. It was simply concocted. It came out in trial that Mrs. Lubert was forgiven 3 or 4 months' rent that James Green Management was suing for, and they just dismissed the suit after she wrote this letter alleging this. Actually, she didn't write the letter. One of James Green Management people wrote it, and she signed it because she was in a wheelchair. And when they said that didn't occur, I even produced a certified copy of the complaint where they had sued her when they told us in court they did not sue her or promise her anything or give her anything. It all proved to be false, but that doesn't change the fact that these evidentiary rulings on whether or not the letter should have come in or the EEOC report comes in without substantiation of some kind of problem. And it doesn't allow anybody to release or to relieve the evidence standards and bring in all kinds of things that are collateral to this case. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. All right, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.